Hey, it's Jed Hearn, host of Wizards, Warriors, and Words. If you're enjoying the writing advice on this show, you might like my new podcast, The Jed Hearn Show, where every week I share the best fantasy writing advice that I've learned from publishing 3 fantasy novels and a best-selling video game. There's over 12 episodes that you can listen to right away, including my top 10 fantasy books of all time, how to make fantasy names that don't suck, 2 rules that make writing effortless, and my complete summaries of Brandon Sanderson's and Neil Gaiman's writing classes, and much more. Check it out by searching for The Jed Hearn Show in your podcast app.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Wizards, Warriors, and Words, a fantasy writing advice podcast. My name is Jed Hearn, author of The Thunder Heist, and I am joined by my fellow writer, Aaron A. Reed. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
So this is a bit of a different episode. We're doing a solo interview with Aaron, who has just recently launched an awesome Kickstarter all about text adventure games, something that I am very passionate about, having written one myself. But before we get to the Kickstarter, which we absolutely will, I kind of want to start with the story that was my first kind of moment that I met Aaron's writing, which is Hollywood Visionary. So Aaron, do you want to kind of talk to us a little bit about what that story involved?
Yeah, and thank you for mentioning it, because I'm really proud of that game, and I'm so happy people, you know, are still finding it and playing it. So yeah, this was a game for a company called Choice of Games that does choice-based interactive fiction on, you know, mobiles and tablets and lots of devices. And my pitch to them, so I kind of knew the guy who ran that company. He and I both came out of the same community making kind of more classic text adventures back in the day. And he'd been trying to get me to write a game for them for a while. And I finally had some time and availability. And I'd had this idea for years and years, like dating back to college, of like a movie making simulator. So I was a film student in college. And I had this idea, it'd be a really cool game if you could like run your own movie studio and put things into production and set the budgets and fiddle with all these little details. And people have made games like that. None of them ever quite did, you know, were like the one in my head that I really wanted to exist. And in my head, I was thinking of it as this very kind of simulationist game, right? With lots of math and numbers and behind the scenes, you know, all of this stuff to calculate, you know, what does making your movie in 3D versus 2D do to the box office and all this stuff. But Choice of Game stuff is really narrative focused, as it should be, right? And so thinking about how to actually make that work as a narrative story, it really shifted it in this different direction. And so it ended up being set in 1950s Hollywood. And when I was writing in the game, it was kind of in the aftermath of this kind of harassment campaign that had come out against a lot of indie game makers. And some of my friends have been personally kind of caught up in that and affected by it. So I set it in the 50s, where you're this kind of indie movie studio, and that's the era in American and Hollywood history when, you know, the McCarthy era happened, and independent filmmakers started to get harassed and everything for sort of following their vision and breaking out of the sort of the mold of what the big studios were doing. And so in my head, this parallel kind of started emerging between these two eras and these two different genres, even, right, movies and games. But it became about how you be creative and how you make, you know, how you prioritize, you know, are you going to follow your artistic dreams versus something that's maybe going to be safer for the people who are working for you? How are you going to balance, you know, financial and artistic and all of these different trade-offs? And there's still some of that simulationist-y stuff in the background of the final game. And that part's a lot of fun. But I think it's kind of presented in this really more interesting package because of that kind of journey of where it came from.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, this was one of the, I think we mentioned this in our initial emails when we were discussing this episode, but I played Hollywood Visionary about maybe 2 years ago, and it was one of the first choice of game stories that I played and inspired me a lot in writing Siege of Treblin 2 years later. And yeah, I love the fact that there are so many conflicting goals and things that are going on in that game, because yeah, you're right. It would be kind of boring if it was just about like just making the movie, but the fact that it's about getting your studio up off the ground, making the movie, dealing with this whole Red Menace and trying to, you know, avoid the McCarthyism or, you know, rebel against it or whatever. And then like your character's personal life and friendships and everything, it leads to this scenario where it's impossible to get everything done that you really want to achieve. And <Yep. laughs> I really like that because it forces you to like focus on what you really want to focus on and makes you realize what matters for you. In earlier versions of the game, you sort of touched upon this, but like, how was it different? Like, was it more, it was more single focused on just individual storylines perhaps, or like, how did it sort of evolve throughout it? Because I know for me, writing my game, it definitely changed a lot through the outlining process.
Yeah, I think something Choice of Games is actually really good at is helping their authors outline and scaffold things in advance, because when you're writing an interactive story, you know, and there's multiple options and multiple pathways, the cost of sort of not having planned things out in advance and having to redraft things or rewrite things is just so much higher because it's kind of multiplied, right, by what a linear, a normal novel would be. So I tend to not write like that actually when I'm writing normal fiction. I tend to be kind of a pantser and just kind of wing it for the first draft at least, and then go back and revise it. But they really, you know, kind of forced me to get more regimented about outlining things and figuring out, you know, for each chapter, what are the key choices and think through all that stuff in advance. So I would say it didn't, for me at least, and also, you know, I'd come from a background of writing other interactive games. So I'd been doing that for a while. It wasn't kind of a brand new thing for me. It was a fairly straightforward process. Like the initial draft was pretty close in structure. I think the biggest thing that evolved was just finding more ways for the choices the player made to come back later in the game. So one of the things in the game is that there's kind of three different people who you might kind of spend time forming a stronger relationship with, whether that's a romantic relationship, one of the characters is kind of an estranged relative who you could, you know, become closer to. As I edited it more, chances to kind of pay off choosing to develop one of those characters into someone you care more about in other parts of the story would occur to me. And I'd be like, oh, this scene, you know, if you spent the time to make this person more important to you, they should clearly come back and have this kind of, you know, unexpected role in this scene or whatever. So it was a lot of just things like that, looking for more places where the player's choices could have an impact. And also to just outside the narrative and the characters on the movie you were making, right? So if you were making a horror movie, it's like, oh, in this scene, I'm going to have a reference to some people mixing fake blood in the background, right? I would just keep thinking of more little moments like that I could introduce at various points in the story to make it feel more and more like your choices had, in fact, you know, affected what was going on.
Yeah, I definitely love that aspect of it, how I think the best choice of game stories do that really well. Like, they remind you of choices that you thought were inconsequential earlier on in the game and then bring them back either as these little callbacks or as things that actually have really dramatic impact. What were some of the main writing lessons that you learned from the game? I know it was a while ago that you wrote this because it came out in 2015 or so, but I'm curious to know like how it might have influenced your writing going forward from that.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned that kind of stylistic change, and I think it actually did introduce me to some of the good parts of planning more carefully in advance. And that I think has carried over to some of my other projects since then. I used to feel that was going to cramp my style or you know, that I couldn't be creative that way. But I've definitely, I think, since that project come around more to like, no, this definitely pays off if you do some of it in advance. So that was one thing for sure. It was also a pretty short time frame. So I think all told, I think Hollywood Visionary is maybe 120,000 words, which is actually pretty short for a lot of Choice of Games games. Some of them can get huge. And I believe,
I think it's,
you know,
150.
That,
I was just looking at it.
It might
before
be.
We started, yeah.
Yeah. That, still, that could be right.
Yeah. Like on the, for average Choice of Games stories these days, that's sort of like on the shorter side, but
yeah,
it still feels good. Yeah.
Yeah. And then of course on any individual person's playthrough, you'll only see maybe 50,000 words of that or something. Mm. So, so there's a lot more, you know, in all of their titles there than you usually see in a single playthrough. So, and I did it in a summer because I was still a grad student at the time. And so, I bet that was the hole in my schedule basically, is I had a summer and I was like, oh, I could write a game for you this summer and not, you know, be a teaching aide or whatever to pay for my rent that summer.
So you wrote this whole thing in 3 months.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Which was
so jealous.
Which was pretty, yeah, it was a pretty accelerated pace. And it was kind of, you know, my only gig for that time. So that was what made it possible. But I tend to be a kind of writer who will work on something for a while and then put it away in a drawer for 6 months or a year and then come back to it. And so, you know, like a lot of my short stories will be ones that I started like 8 years ago. Whoa. And every year or two pulled out, tweaked a little bit, and then put back because I felt like it wasn't done yet. I couldn't figure out how to get it done. So actually being forced to like, nope, in this one window, you've got to start it, plan it, execute it, draft it, finish it, edit it, was not usually how I work. So, but yeah, again, they have great editorial support. They have, you know, people who actually, you know, read your writing and understand how those kind of stories work and give you great feedback. And that was super helpful to have, you know, editors who are, you know, actually helping me improve the story, not just looking for typos and stuff.
Yes.
So that helped a lot to feel like I was, you know, kind of part of a team making this happen. Yeah, it was a great experience. I hope to write something for them again someday.
Well, I would certainly love to play it because I love that game. And yeah, it definitely made me think, okay, this is something that I really want to try creating myself.
Awesome.
Shifting gears a bit, I'd love to talk about the Kickstarter. So do you want to introduce us to 50 years of text adventure games?
Yeah, so this project started in early 2020, just kind of a passing date somewhere caught my attention that 2021 was going to be the 50th anniversary of the Oregon Trail, which a lot of people my generation grew up playing. And a lot of people don't know this, but the very original version of that game was a text-only game that you played over a teletype. And in the 80s, there was kind of a more graphical remake that got pretty well known. But the original was a teletype game that debuted in 1971 in a classroom in Minnesota. So I was thinking, oh, you know, as someone who has written interactive fiction of various kinds my whole life, maybe it would be interesting to do something to commemorate this 50th anniversary, because that's an interesting number. And somehow I got the idea from there to turn that into a blog series that ran during 2021, where each week I would pick a game from a kind of year chronologically starting in 1971. So the first week I'd do a game from 71, the next week I'd do a game from 72, and go through the whole sort of 50-year history of this medium. And each game I picked to do kind of a deep dive into how it worked, what it was about, really kind of get into what made that particular game tick. And that, so I started writing that in mid 2020. And so I had a bunch of articles pre-written when 2021 started. It still was pretty down to the wire because it turns out writing one in-depth article a week for a year is kind of hard. So so that also was a thing that changed some of my writing style and instilled a lot of discipline and stuff in me that I didn't necessarily natively have. But
how
it was also really
against like other projects and other things you had to do.
I came at this from a really lucky position because where I was at when I started that was I had just started doing contracting work and I had landed a big long-term contract that was 20 hours a week, but was basically paying my rent and all my expenses and stuff. So
nice.
I basically was able to treat that project like a half-time job for the bulk of the time I was writing it. If I was entirely doing it in my, you know, spare time and weekends, it might not have been possible to get it done in that time frame.
Sure.
So I was definitely kind of coming from this privileged position, which was a unique moment in my life where I could make that happen, which was cool.
Was the contract related to writing, or was it a different thing? Or I'm just curious to know the specifics.
So I've had a very interesting career where so my interactive fiction work led me to grad school, where I went to a program with a bunch of other people studying interactive narrative stuff. And then kind of through that, Yeah, it was a really cool program at the University of California, Santa Cruz, with some really cool faculty and really cool other students. And sort of through that and through the people I met through that, I did some stuff in AI and specifically character AI for games. So after grad school, I was involved for a while in a startup trying to make essentially more dynamic NPC characters for games, for digital games. And that was really interesting. It didn't end up going anywhere, as is the case with 95% of startups. But
that is so cool, though.
Yeah, it was a really fun project. And then this contract that let me do this project was similar work, kind of developing NPC characters, but outside the domain of games. It was actually a program to try to develop anti-scammer technology. So when you get emails that are trying to, you know, defraud you or your grandma of hard-earned money, the kind of concept is, what if you could turn that communication over to a bot that would waste the scammer's time and maybe get it to reveal information? So like flipping the script they're trying
to
do.
So you're using like a scam bot to scam the scammer.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was really interesting, and it was funny because it was really similar to writing characters for games, but instead of very suspicious, skeptical players, you had these completely unsuspecting scammers who would just go along with, you know, anything your bot said. They would just assume, you know, maybe you were having a bad day or whatever, and they, you
know, wow,
try to
so
keep
funny.
Going. Yeah, it was a really interesting project. Anyway, so yeah, so because that was only half time, I was able to focus on this blog series for a bit, and it was kind of also too, you know, it started right at the start of the pandemic, and I was, you know, kind of, you know, lonely and depressed like everyone else, and missing grad school days, honestly. And so the idea of like spending a bunch of time when I was home alone, you know, or not going out with friends or whatever, like deep diving into the history of this genre of games that I like a lot, was sort of appealing. And it was actually kind of therapeutic in a way to just have this like, you know, extremely ambitious project to just sink a bunch of my time and energy into.
Yeah, I definitely feel that. Like having a really ambitious and creatively fulfilling project is like one of the best ways to feel meaningful and fulfilled, in my experience. So yeah. I'm glad I was able to do that for you.
Yeah, it did. And so then the outcome of that basically was that I had a large book's worth of these articles. And so the sort of new iteration of the project now is all of those 50 those 50 deep articles and all these games are being revised and turned into a book called 50 Years of Text Games, which is sort of this broad look at all of these individual moments in the history of computer games without graphics. It's kind of my one sentence pitch. So
yeah, it looks awesome. I'm definitely going to be backing it as well. It is currently at do you want to tell the audience where the Kickstarter is currently?
You might have a more recent number than me. Last time I looked, it was at like $165,000 or something like that. So
yep, that's all right. That's yeah, which is insane. Like that is so cool. Everybody that I've told about this is like, that's such a niche thing. Like text adventure games. This guy's like done such a huge Kickstarter for it. Do you think the nicheness has actually helped a lot in terms of running that Kickstarter?
I think so, because, you know, anyone over 40 or 45 grew up playing those games. So there's millions and millions of people who remember, you know, that history themselves. I think there's a lot of younger people who are really interested in it, even if they, you know, missed the time when that genre was in its prime. And then, of course, there's still a lot of people writing these games in all kinds of forms. And that's one of the interesting things to me is, you know, the perception is that this is a really niche genre, and it is in a lot of ways. But you keep finding these games that are actually like insanely popular and influential. So I talk about like Dwarf Fortress, for example, which, you know, is millions of people have played. It inspired Minecraft, which is the best-selling video game of all time. There's games like Lifeline, which was the game from 2015 where you were texting an astronaut and trying to help him out of trouble. That for a while was the top-selling game on the App Store. So you kind of just keep finding these games that are mostly text, right, that are using their words and their writing to tell their story and not really relying as much on graphics as these, you know, mainstream and influential games. They just keep kind of popping up in different forms and wearing different guises. So I think that's really interesting. And I think the scope of the book is kind of moving beyond one particular genre, right? So it's looking at everything from text adventures to mobile dating sims that are largely sort of texting based. It's looking at roguelikes. It's looking at all kinds of narrative games, experimental games, all kinds of different stuff. And it's kind of capturing this really interesting broad section of gaming that I think hasn't really been all discussed together in the same conversation in quite the same way before. So yeah, it's cool to me. I think it's niche, but it's kind of surprisingly connected to the rest of gaming in all of these different interesting ways.
That's a good way of putting it. And I think, yeah, you're right. I guess this stuff in a way is like the kind of foundational, the kind of foundational pieces that have allowed other games to develop off it. And even within the scope of text adventure games, like I think, you know, Choice of Games have an email list of what is it, like 50,000 people on there or something like that. There is still a huge audience of people who like this stuff. And I think the fact that it has both of the, like with novels, what's great about novels is that you can get your audience to imagine things that you would never have the budget to produce in a film. And what's great about games is that the player can feel a sense of control and a sense of immersion like nothing else. And
yeah,
text adventure games are amazing because they blend those two things together. Like you get all the benefits of writing a novel in terms of being able to leverage the player's imagination or reader's imagination. And then you get all the benefits of the game being interactive and, you know, allowing people to really feel like they are living the story. So, and then you add that to the fact that like, it's a very low barrier to entry as well.
Yeah, exactly.
It becomes this like really interesting mixture where, yeah, suddenly there are a lot of cool and innovative things that people are sort of doing within it.
Yeah, it's definitely a genre where a single person with an artistic vision can tell an interactive story, right? It's a lot harder to do that when you need to have, you know, a huge open game world built with graphics and sound effects and you know, all the multimedia that you expect from mainstream games. You know, we were talking about Hollywood Visionary, which, you know, clearly I think even if you haven't played it, it came across that had a specific artistic vision behind it. And so many of these games are just made by sole creators with something to say, whether that's a cool world they want you to explore, whether that's a statement they have. And it's just, it's really neat to have a medium where one person can make a whole game and share that with the world. So I like that about it a lot.
And I think that's something people are craving more than ever these days, because like a lot of the movies and stuff and TV shows that come out these days feel like there isn't that sole creative visionary behind it. It feels like it's something that was made through a lot of focus groups and a lot of discussion in a boardroom or whatever. And that's fine. Sometimes it leads to great stories when you are, I guess, writing by committee. But I think a lot of people are like craving those more, you know, driven by a singular artistic vision style stories. And the ones that do come out like that are the ones that I think people really resonate with. And yeah, I don't know. Do you think that's something that's sort of going on at the moment, or am I just being?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. I mean, I definitely notice in myself, there are evenings when I want to watch something on Netflix because, you know, I know it's going to have like a baseline production budget and level of quality and everything. But then there's nights where I'm sort of like, Netflix just feels like most shows on Netflix don't feel especially edifying to me. I want to like read a novel, or I want to watch, you know, an experimental indie film, or I want to get something kind of more personal. So yeah, I think we're in an interesting age where we just have so much high quality mass produced entertainment that's really good in some ways. But if you consume too much of it, I think you do kind of miss more individual voices and more personal stories.
Yeah, and I love the fact that like both of them can coexist, right? Like,
yeah,
love the fact that Marvel movies are doing their thing. I really enjoy a lot of them. And I also love the fact that like, yeah, sole game creators can make like a text adventure game, which is a super fun experience. And it's cool that like we are now in a point where you can sort of do those both things. But I guess like bringing it back to the Kickstarter, was that sort of the case in the early days? Like, I'm so curious to know if you were someone who was trying to write like a text adventure game in the 70s or whenever your book starts, like what was the process back then? Like what sort of devices and companies were exploring this?
Yeah, it's one of the, another interesting thing about this project to me at least is that this history is really also just the history of computers, because it starts, you know, right when people were first getting access to some of the earliest computers and continues right up to the present day. So you kind of inevitably have to, you know, go through this series of kind of cultural and technical sea changes that happened as computers changed and as people's access to computers changed. So yeah, so when the book starts in 1971, and that was still the era of mainframes. So you didn't have a computer at home. If you were lucky enough to work for a university or be a student in a university, or maybe a really big business that had a computer, you might be able to get computer access, but you probably weren't operating the computer yourself. What you'd do is you'd write a program on a punch tape machine, which was not a computer. It was basically just a typewriter that would kind of punch holes in a piece of paper tape or in a paper card that were the binary data of your program. You would spend a while making sure, you know, every line of your program was what you wanted it to do, you know, double checking for errors. And then you'd hand that paper tape or that stack of cards to a technician who would run it through the computer, maybe in a day or two, depending on, you know, how much availability there was. And then you'd get the results back out, which would be either a printout or another paper tape or cards with the date of your output. And then you'd go look over that and see if your program ran okay and figure out what you wanted to do for the next revision. So compared to what we have today, where you can just instantly get feedback, it was this incredibly slow process that mostly happened offline, right? With just you sitting with your code by yourself. So when your iteration cycle is that slow, that obviously really limits how much, you know, how fast you can change things if you discover mistakes, how quickly you can learn how to make, you know, the machine do what you want it to do. So a lot of the early games, in fact, don't really come until you start seeing what was then called an interactive environment, which is where you could actually sit at a keyboard, type something into the computer and have it immediately respond to you. And one of the early stories that I'm quite fond of in the book was the game Hunt the Wumpus came out of a place called the People's Computer Company, which wasn't actually a company. It was kind of a joke because they were a very kind of hippie nonprofit.
It does sound like a joke name for a company.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But what their idea was they bought a computer, which in that time still, you know, was like a 5 or 6 figure purchase. And they set up this kind of public storefront where anyone could come in off the street and play with it. And they had free classes. They had, meetups where people could come. But they were really trying to move past, you know, it's only scientists and, you know, quote unquote, the right people using computers. Like computers should be for everyone. And what happened, which was fascinating, is this really interesting community formed up around that place and the people playing with it. And some of those people were interested in trying to make computer games. And what I think you see evolve out of that is basically one of the earliest computer game design conversations, because one person would make a game, show it to his friends there, and then one of those friends would say like, oh, I know a way to make this better. And then they'd make their spin-off version of their game and then show it, you know, at the next meetup. And you had these games that were kind of evolving over, you know, a period of weeks and months. So Hunt the Wumpus is pretty famous as an early game, but you can actually trace it's sort of the third or fourth move in this conversation of games people were having that were iteratively improving on things that people were doing before it. And I think that's why you got, it, you know, it evolved to a point where it was actually an interesting game that people thought was cool and wanted to share, because it was able to kind of have that circle of feedback and improve, which is really cool to see. Communities have always, I think, been a part of this. That's where you get, you know, those conversations that challenge people and give them an audience, right, to want to make cool stuff for. And the nature of those communities has changed as the technology has changed, right? So the internet changed how those communities could form. You know, bulletin boards a little before the internet were another way that could happen. But that's really been an interesting thread, is that when you get a bunch of people together who are all interested in doing the same thing and showing off to each other and improving on each other's work, really cool stuff happens.
So we start in that period where it's sort of these smaller groups that are creating these games and giving feedback to each other. And then you mentioned that there's like, you know, there's people of a certain generation who just grew up playing these things. So clearly there was a point at which some companies like figured out how to kind of get this at a bigger scale, how to commercialize it and everything. How did that sort of come apart? Because I'm always interested in like seeing how people take things that are creatively and artistically fulfilling and figure out a way to like monetize them so that they can do them more, so that they can do them at a bigger scale and kind of like spread them to more people. So I'd love to know how this medium sort of found its footing.
Yeah. So it was a really interesting transition. So it's really funny looking back on the 70s in particular, because the notion of someone buying and selling computer software, and even more particularly computer games, was still just kind of a pretty foreign notion, right? Like, so huge companies like IBM would give you software when you paid, you know, $200,000 for one of their machines. You know, you can maybe hire someone to write software for you, but there weren't, you know, you didn't go and buy software off a store shelf yet. That just wasn't a thing. And there's actually a really funny thing where in one of the early basic games called Star Trader, it's a sci-fi trading game where you're going around the galaxy trading goods. One of the goods you can trade is software. And people don't really get this today, but that was science fiction in the 70s when that game was first written.
That's so good.
Yeah.
We're living in the future.
Yeah. So around 77, 78, what happened was you started to see the first generation of home computers. So a cheap enough, small enough computer that a person could buy one at Radio Shack, take it back to their house and play with it as much as they wanted, rather than, you know, only being able to do it at their office or whatever. And that, of course, then created a market for software for those computers. And so you started to see companies selling at first productivity software. Around end of 79, 80, you saw the first computer game companies spring up. And one of the very first was a company called Adventure International that tried to market text adventure games for home computers. And this was an incredible challenge because that first generation of computers were so tiny as far as their memory and storage capacity and processor speed compared to even the mainframe computers of the 70s, that people just assumed it was impossible to put something as complex as like a computer game where you were moving around a map and fighting enemies and stuff on one of those computers, because they would have, I have a bit in the book where I say, I have a paragraph kind of talking about this, and I say, a lot of these games had to fit in an amount of storage smaller than the text used to store this paragraph, right? It was literally like 1,000 bytes of storage space, maybe. So it was an incredible technical challenge to try to figure out how to get a complicated game running on those machines. But there was this huge demand for it because people had played some of the mainframe games of the 70s, like Adventure, had been super popular, and they could get pretty big because those computers even then could store, you know, multiple megabytes of text, which is a lot for a text game. So people wanted to recapture that experience of exploring these, you know, cool textual universes on home computers. So there was all this motivation. And some of those early games, just because they were some of the first to do it, sold incredibly well. Another fun story from that period is, so Zork, which was one of the earliest, it was the first computer game to sell more than 1 million copies, is one statistic about it. But it came out in 1980. In 1985, it was still on the top of sales charts because when it launched, it was basically the only thing in its class, right? It was the only adventure game with that level of
sophistication.
Yeah,
it was creating this whole new category for itself. That's remarkable.
So, exactly. So yeah, it was sort of the demo everyone would use to show off their new computer. And so for a couple of years in the early 80s, everyone who bought a new computer wanted to get Zork so that they could show off, you know, what it could do. So that's kind of an example of right at the beginning of that industry, right? It was really small, but then obviously it expanded. And by the end of the 80s, it was a multi-billion dollar industry, right? But it was a pretty meteoric rise, right? Like within 10 years, going from not existing to being like a major market share in the entertainment sector.
That is huge. Yeah, I find that so fascinating. And that's why I'm so excited to read the book, because yeah, like, it's just so cool learning the history about all this stuff that I guess I've entered into like very late in the picture, but it's always it's always fascinating to see how those early influences have affected, you know, even companies like Choice of Games up until today, for example.
Yeah.
In terms of the Kickstarter itself, this is your third Kickstarter, and like the other two Kickstarters have been successful, but this is on a totally new level. Would you say that's accurate?
Yes.
Yeah. I really do like what you were doing with the other Kickstarters. It looks cool, because I was researching them the other day, and they're all like so different. And Yeah, I appreciate that.
I think I mentioned earlier I've had an interesting career.
Yeah,
so I've bounced around between games, writing books. Now I'm writing books about games. So kind of been all over the map.
It's very cool though. It's very cool. As a quick digression, do you want to just tell everybody about the Kickstarter that I found particularly interesting? Was the book where you're communicating with like the AI of a dead author.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So this was a really fun project. It was extremely ambitious. We bit off about 3 times as much as we could chew. We kind of made it work, but it was an uphill battle. So this project was a book and a game that worked together. So Icebound was kind of the unifying name of the project. The game was called the Icebound. The book was called the Icebound Concordance. The game was called the Icebound. Oh God, now I've forgotten the name of my own game.
Oh no.
Anyway, Icebound. The Icebound Compendium and the Icebound Concordance. That's right.
Hey, don't worry. I like forget. I had a friend asking me about a character in one of my books the other day, and I was like, yes, that character that I wrote from that book. So. And I've only written like a few things, so I can.
One of those moments. Wait. Yep. Yep. But basically, when we started, so I made this with my partner Jacob Garby, and when we started working on this, the iPad specifically with the forward-facing camera had just come out, which enabled kind of early augmented reality stuff to start happening, and we were both in a digital art grad program at the time. And we had got this grant to make a game that used augmented reality. And we were both kind of writers though. So we were like, okay, well, what if you made a game where you're communicating with this character, but you can show him pages from this book that comes with the game to change what's happening in the game. So essentially using the book as like an input mechanism to the game. So the story we came up with was very meta, which if you know either of us tracks. So it was about a writer who died and left this unfinished manuscript behind about polar explorers and this mysterious Arctic research base. And in the future, he gets resurrected as an AI, basically by a publishing company that wants him to finish this book because it, like The Mystery of Edwin Drood or a lot of other unfamous stories, it became really popular after his death. All these people want to know how the story was supposed to end. So in the game, you're sort of collaborating with this kind of digital ghost of this writer who's sort of like totally lost. Like he has no idea how the story was supposed to end, how he, you know, what the ending was supposed to be, what the right ending is. And the book has all of these fragments of imagery from his life and from his stories. And when it works, which it sometimes does, I think it's this really cool thing because you actually kind of feel a bit like you're collaborating and having this conversation of like, well, maybe the ultimate theme of your stories is loss. So I'm going to show you a picture of, you know, your estranged daughter. How do you feel about that? Right. So it was really ambitious, like I said, but it was a lot of fun. We did a Kickstarter for that that I think about doubled our pretty modest goal. Nice. That game got into IndieCade, which was really cool, and IGF and a couple other game festivals. And the technical part was pretty tricky because, like I mentioned, it was still pretty early days for augmented reality. So we were using, you know, pretty early unsupported libraries, and every time an update came out, it would break everything. And so there were a lot of technical obstacles to overcome. But it was a pretty cool project, I think.
That is cool. Can people still get that? Like, can they order it off your website or something? Or
So the game, part of the problem with it being so cutting edge was it was really dependent on a lot of things like webcam drivers and stuff like that. So the game still sort of works on some computers, but we basically don't support it anymore because so much hardware now isn't compatible with it, and we don't have the ability to easily go and update it anymore. It's verging on being a lost game, I'm afraid.
The price of
but
innovation.
you can still see our really cool trailer for it, which
yes, the trailer is very epic. The trailer is very epic. Really like that. That was something that that definitely impressed me about this Kickstarter as well, because I'm working on a Kickstarter as well with a friend at the moment, not in writing, it's for a different thing, but yeah, just like the amount of moving pieces that need to go into it and stuff is really fascinating. And I'd love to get your take as someone who has done 3 Kickstarters now, and this last one is in particular has been a huge hit. Like, what kind of would be your best advice for people who are creative and they're thinking about doing a Kickstarter for a certain project they're working on?
Yeah, it definitely is a lot of work. That is an accurate statement. I think the single biggest advice I would give people is you really need to have done most of the work before you launch. So much of it is about setting up, you know, if you're going to get media coverage, talking to people well in advance of launch to get that set up to go. It's about, you know, pre-writing some of the content you're going to drop during the Kickstarter, people interested, because once you hit the launch button and there's this, you know, countdown clock looming over your head, it gets a lot harder to try to, you know, write these insightful, engaging blog posts in the heat of the moment. A lot of the work is just really front loaded. So coming up with a plan for, you know, knowing what your goal is, knowing what your audience is, who you're trying to reach, and then figuring out in advance, you know, how you're going to reach those people, what you're going to do to keep them excited. I tend to make big spreadsheets with, you know, potential audiences and potential things I could, you know, drop or announce or reveal that would get their interest. So, you know, I might have a row that's like my Facebook friends. I might have a row that's like, you know, people who backed this previous project I did. You know, I might have a row that's Twitter, right? So just like, what are all the places where I could reach people? And then it's like, okay, if I'm going to reveal, you know, a sample chapter from the book, right, for this project, like which of those groups, you know, would be likely to be interested in that? And then I kind of try to stagger those so that each of those groups is getting, they're hearing about the project a few times, but none of them is getting kind of overwhelmed with, you know, a constant bombardment of hype for it, right? So yeah, it's just, for me, I think some people maybe don't prep as much as I do, but I really like to have that kind of battle plan and as much of that stuff kind of ready to go as possible so that when launch day comes, it's just kind of like, okay, like we know what we're doing. Like Tuesday, we're going to drop this. Thursday, we're going to drop this. Go through the steps. But yeah, preparation.
That is good. What are some other like marketing tactics that you have kind of used for this one? Have you used any paid ads at all, or has it been purely just like organic? What's the
Actually have not. So I have historically been pretty good at word of mouth and pretty bad at advertising and marketing.
Sure.
In my previous campaigns, I have experimented with paid ads on, you know, social media sites, things like that. You know, sometimes targeted ads on like a place where fans of that genre might be reading or whatever. And I just haven't had much luck with it. So for this campaign, I really doubled down on, you know, this is going to live or die on word of mouth. So because I started it as a blog series, I built up a lot of subscribers from that. And kind of what I was hoping was because I had a paid option for the blog series, but there weren't any subscriber exclusive posts. So you could read, you know, the entire content for free. And I've kind of used this strategy before on some of my projects. I think actually, if you give people a free version and then at the end say, if you liked this, here's a premium version you can get too. For me, at least, that tends to work pretty well. And I get a lot of people who are like, wow, yeah, this was really cool. I want to support you. So I think a lot of the people backing this actually have already read most of the book. They're just really excited about owning like a nice hardback edition of it, which I think is cool. So yeah, that was a big thing for me this time, was really relying on that word of mouth. And one thing I did that I think in hindsight was pretty smart was I made a really nice page of ways people could help spread the word about the project. So here's a 50-word blurb about it. Here's some images about it sized for social media. Here's some links, not just to the project, but to like some interesting posts or some interesting content. And I've been kind of including that in my updates. Like, if you want to help get the word out about this project, here's a link with some assets. And I think that's really helped because a lot of people maybe, you know, are excited about the project and want to help spread the word. But if you sit them down in front of, you know, social media and say, make up something to talk about this project, they're not going to know what to say. So having stuff they can copy paste, having a way to make it so that they can reshare the project with just a couple clicks, I think actually has helped a lot and encouraged a lot of people to help me spread the word about it, which has been really nice to see.
Even something as simple as you had a line on the Kickstarter page that went something like, if you run a podcast or a blog or something like that and you want to interview me, feel free to reach out. And that's exactly how this conversation happened. So,
I'm glad that worked.
Yeah, it definitely worked. I don't know if you've gotten, have you gotten many other like interviews through that or whatever?
It's mostly gone the other direction. So that was another thing I did in advance for this Kickstarter was I looked into a lot of podcasts and blogs that were covering retro games or that were covering, just different things that might connect to, you know, people who would be interested in this book, and reached out. I guess started about 6 weeks maybe before my launch date to a bunch of those and just said, hey, you know, I've got this project I think your audience might be interested in. Here's my background. I can talk about these kind of subjects, you know, if you'd be interested in having me on or write a blog post for your or guest post for your blog or whatever, reach out and let me know. And that's been pretty successful. I've had a lot of people reach out and say, oh yeah, that sounds really cool. So that kind of stuff this time around has really been where I've devoted my energy, rather than trying to do much, you know, cold calls to media outlets or paid marketing or things like that. I've really kind of gone all in on word of mouth, basically. but it seems to have worked for me this time, which is great to see.
I think, there's some good lessons and parallels here for, because if you're listening to this right now and you're a fantasy author and you're going to self-publish, I think there's some fantastic lessons here in terms of the reason why Aaron's Kickstarter has been so successful is because you've built up that audience for a long time. Like, you're clearly passionate about this. You understand what your audience wants and, you know, you're kind of uniquely positioned to deliver that in an interesting way. And I think if you're someone who hasn't published your first book yet, maybe you don't use Kickstarter necessarily, but just that idea of making sure that you're trying to build up an audience beforehand and really understand, like, what do fantasy readers want? That is the kind of thing that's going to allow you to have a successful launch in the future. So these are all like really good lessons, not just for people who want to run a Kickstarter, but for any creative who is trying to get a project off the ground. So I really appreciate you sharing that stuff.
Absolutely.
I'd be curious to know, because this is as I just mentioned, this is a sort of fantasy writing podcast and I'm a big fantasy fan. I'd love to know like how fantasy has played a role within the evolution of text games and how that has sort of evolved over time.
Yeah, it's definitely a big part of it. So a really interesting kind of thing you can trace in the early history of computer games and specifically text games is what people's primary source of inspiration was. And there was this really interesting moment in 1974, which is when Dungeons and Dragons came out, where before that you saw a ton of games being made inspired by Star Trek, because that was kind of like the dominant geek property at that moment. And after that, you saw everyone wanted to make a fantasy game inspired by Dungeons and Dragons, because that was the new cool thing everyone was talking about. A lot of those early influential games were just kind of dripping in the fantasy tropes that D&D itself was kind of recycling from, things like Tolkien and Howard and a lot of other sources. So one of the early games that fits in that category is a game that went by a couple names. It was known as D&D, just the letters D&D, not an ampersand, and also called The Game of Dungeons. That was released probably in 1975. Some of these early games, it's a little hard to date. And it was basically the first roguelike game. So if you know that genre, it's kind of characterized by a top-down, usually procedurally generated map that you're exploring, and there's randomly generated monsters and loot, and you're just kind of trying to continuously level up your character and stuff. So Diablo was famously like kind of a graphical roguelike and kind of brought that genre into the graphics realm, but it originated kind of as a text-only genre. And it's actually named for a game that came out in 1980 called Rogue, but people were making games in that style earlier. And so this game from 75 was made for a really interesting educational computer system called Plato that was way ahead of its time. So it had a touch screen that could show graphics. It had a high resolution monitor. And this was at a time where most computers still had like a text only teletype kind of interface. Yeah, it was a really interesting system. And it was basically designed, it was part of this huge government grant to try to catch US students up in education, because there was a perception in the early 70s that the US was falling behind the Soviets and other countries. So all this money got poured into making this cutting edge computer platform for students. But of course, immediately the students, once they got access to this, started figuring out how they could make games for it. So, and they made some incredibly elaborate games. So D&D was relatively simple, but it kind of spun off into this series of fantasy games that invented a lot of the tropes that you see now in MMORPG style online games. So a key thing about the Plato computers is they were all networked together. So it was pretty easy to actually make multiplayer games and get all the students in your class playing the game instead of doing their fraction lessons or whatever they were supposed to be doing. So you saw these, you know, these like fantasy adventure games designed for like 10 or 15 players to all join together in a party. Some of these games, you know, invented tropes like end bosses or like, just a lot of the stuff you see, the dynamics you see in modern multiplayer games. And just these like huge fantasy worlds that you would explore with text, with so a lot of these games had kind of very primitive line graphics. One of the first kind of games with a 3D perspective was for the Plato system. So that genre all through the 70s, the fantasy genre was like really kind of the coolest thing you could port to the computer and recreate that kind of experience for your friends. So definitely hugely influential. And I think the whole genre text adventure, right? Adventure comes from this sensation that fantasy often captures so well of like, you know, we're going into this fantastical cool world. We're going on a cool quest. We're gonna probably learn how to do some dangerous magic or, you know, yes. Make some terrible mistakes. It really, you know, it was a massive influence on the origin of computer games.
It's so cool to me, the idea of a text adventure game that is like multiplayer. I can't even wrap my head around how I would write something like that. Like, it was so complicated doing a choice of game story that was just a single player. How does that work? Like, multiple people going at it at the same time?
Yeah. So the first people to kind of try that basically very quickly realized that you can't just add a bunch of players to a game designed for a single player to play. It won't work, right? So, sure. So like a famous example is Adventure, right? Which kind of named that genre and was one of the first big, big text adventure hits. It starts off, in most of the game, you're exploring a cave and it starts off above ground and you have to find a lamp that you can use to light your way in the cave. Well, if you add multiple people to that, the first one gets the lamp, goes down into the cave, and then everyone else is screwed because they don't have the lamp, right? So the very earliest hacks were basically people saying, well, I mean, technically we could add multiple players to this game. Let's try it and see what happens. But it just kind of everything broke, right? Because the kinds of puzzles and stuff that work in that environment just didn't work with multiple players. So they very quickly had to kind of pivot to, well, if you do have a lot of other humans running around this environment, the most interesting thing stops being the environment necessarily, becomes the other humans, right? Mm. So what puzzles can you do that maybe require multiple people to be able to solve? What maybe instead of solving environmental puzzles, the focus more becomes kind of player versus player puzzles, right? So defeating other people in combat or trying to best, you know, work your way up the ranks to become more powerful than the other players. So a lot of the environment became more about supporting different interactions between human players than existing just kind of for its own sake, right? Or as a place to explore for exploration's sake. It's really interesting in those early games, those early multiplayer games, you can see them kind of discovering how to make a game for multiple people, how to make a simulated environment, right? That multiple people can have fun in real time as they're you know, trying things out and experimenting. It was a really interesting moment in that history.
I've got two last questions for you and then we'll start to wrap up. The first one is, having looked at all of these different games and having written a couple of text adventure games yourself, what do you think are the kind of patterns or commonalities or that you see in the games that are really good? So in other words, like, what are the kind of broader writing lessons that you have learned by examining all of these different games? I'm curious if there's some sort of overlap or commonality between 50 years worth of these stories.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think one thing you definitely see is that I think hypothetically, there's kind of two different kinds of immersive games, just in general, right? Even outside of text games, right? There's a game that's basically like the holodeck on Star Trek, where it's like, here you are in this fantasy world. You can go anywhere, you can do anything. It's just kind of a sandbox, right? And have fun. And games like Skyrim or No Man's Sky maybe are kind of trying to emulate that feeling, even though it's obviously really hard to do. Another kind of game, though, is something where it might look like it's an open world where you could go anywhere and do anything, but actually there's a pretty particular plot the author has in mind for you to go through. And those games, in a lot of ways, can be more fun because, you know, as we and everyone listening to this podcast knows, writers actually do know how to tell good stories. and letting one of them tell you a story is maybe not a bad idea. But I think where you see that kind of game be really successful is when the author has figured out how to make you feel like you are the one discovering the story and you were the one figuring out how to do things, even though you're actually being led by the nose through the author's pre-scripted story, right? Yes. And it's totally not bad to do that as an author. And a lot of amazing interactive games have you know, a pre-planned story. But there's something really magical about feeling like you're the one who's making it happen. You're the one who's discovering it. So that's, I think, something that I think a lot of the famous games from the genre do really well. And it's something that's maybe kind of hard as if you're setting out to write one of those games for the first time, that's not something you might necessarily think about for yourself, but a lot of what you're doing is really, kind of magic tricks, right? You're creating a really cool environment with all this stuff in it, but there's actually only one really interesting detail that you want to look at more closely. And, oh, it turns out there's an interesting clue or the next piece of the plot behind that interesting detail, but you want the player to feel like, oh, I noticed that rock. What's under that rock? Even if you were really carefully sculpting that moment. Yes. So the rock was going to be the only thing they were going to pay attention to, right?
Or even if you had it so that no matter what they chose to investigate, they would find the clue underneath it.
Right, right. Yes. Yep. Yep. So I think it's this very interesting kind of experience crafting that you're doing when you're creating a story like that, where you're kind of trying to create this series of magical moments for your player that will let them kind of uncover your story in a way that's very pleasing to them in an interactive environment.
Cool. That's a really good answer. The other one I had is, you have had such a varied and just such a, how do I even describe this? Like such a, I guess, non-linear creative career by the sounds of it. Like we've mentioned this a couple of times, right? But you've done so many different projects, and I'm curious for people who do aspire to have that kind of creative career where they are doing all these different things, like what advice would you give to somebody like that? Or what kind of lessons have you learned along your own journey?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like a lot of people in my situation say this, but I feel like I've been really lucky in a lot of ways because I've had a lot of freedom to experiment on things for various reasons. You know, I've kind of had that freedom to fail, right? So I can try something and see if it works, which is a real luxury. I think to the extent that any of my successes have been attributable to me, it's been because I have definitely, in all my projects, really pursued the figuring out, what am I trying to say? Like what's the non-compromising version of this project, right? So if when I started working on text adventures, I was like, I really want to make like the best text adventure. Like what would I have to do to make the best text adventure? And I put a lot of time and, you know, a lot of energy into making that happen rather than just being like, well, this is just a little text adventure. No one's going to play it, whatever. A joke I keep making is that I keep finding more and more obscure projects to do. So I'm sort of taking the opposite trajectory of trying to make my work like more accessible and more commercial. I've done like a lot of weird like experimental text games and things like that. Arguably writing a blog series about, you know, a supposedly dead genre falls into that category. But yeah, like I've done all of these weird things, but I've like really done them, if that makes sense. Like when we did this weird augmented reality game, it was like, no, we're gonna really
gonna go for
dig
it.
Into yeah making this everything it can be. So, yeah, definitely I would say, you know, as advice to people, if you're working on something and you're not sure it's going to have an audience, you're not sure, you know, it's going to be commercial or whatever, there are definitely reasons to maybe listen to that voice and say like, well, maybe this could pivot to something that's, you know, more marketable or whatever. But I think there's also a lot of value in pursuing it to where the project leads you, right? And like letting it become what it wants to become, because that's a lot of the time how you get something that's really unique and really, you know, something that seems fresh and interesting.
I definitely back that advice, because it's funny that you use those words of like, I want this to be, you know, the best text adventure game there is, and applying that sort of philosophy to everything that you're doing. Because I remember when I was starting to write Siege of Trebland, I told myself that as well. Like there was probably one period where I was like, I don't know, it might've been a day where I was just phoning it in. And I realized like, oh, you might never get another opportunity to do a text adventure game like this. You should try to make it like the best thing you possibly can. Sorry, my voice is dying over here. And yeah, like that attitude of just trying to make like whatever is in front of you right now, trying to make that the best thing that you have ever done and the best thing that exists in that genre. Like you might not never reach that high bar, but just having that goal will make it so much better than if you're just approaching it with this sort of disposable mindset of thinking that I just want to get this out of the way and get this done. So yeah, I totally back that advice. And that's something that I tell myself all the time. Like I always try to approach each book or each project with the mindset of like, I want this to be the best thing that I've ever written. And I think it was Christopher Nolan who was talking about that with his movies. He was like, every single movie that I make, I think is going to be the best movie that I've ever made. And if you're not approaching it with that mindset, then why even bother attempting it in the first place? So I really back that.
Yeah, I like that quote.
So Aaron's Kickstarter, 50 Years of Text Adventure Games, is up now. So you can go and check that out. I will put a link to that as well down in the show notes. I'm going to be backing it. I'm really excited to read it. And yeah, thanks for making such a cool and unique project. It's going to be
a joy
to go through.
I'm hoping a lot of people are going to learn a lot and get a kick out of reading it. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
No worries. Thanks again, Aaron.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.